From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. YouTube turned 10 this week. What started as a way to share home video snippets is now a huge media player. 300 hours of video uploaded to the site every minute. More than a billion users. It's given everyone a video outlet and every video a place to play. Now the big players are in there alongside the amateurs. This hour on Point, a decade of YouTube. And what comes next? 10 years ago this month, there's YouTube. Within a few weeks, the first video ever uploaded onto YouTube. It was called Me at the Zoo. Here's one of the site's co-founders. This is Jawed Karim, and his little bit from the zoo has since then been viewed more than 17 million times.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. And the cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long fronts, and that's cool.
Me at the Zoo, and for a long time, things were kind of in that realm. All kinds of family video went up here back in 2007. Charlie and his brother Harry became YouTube sensations. Home video then went viral. Video of Charlie biting his brother's finger currently has over 811 million views.
Ooh, ouch! Ouch! Ouch, Charlie!
Charlie bit my finger, 800 million plus, but it's just kept on going. That's years ago now. If you haven't kept up with us, first today from New York is Tad Friend, staff writer at The New Yorker. His recent article is The Stars of YouTube and Vine. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. You'll find a collection of YouTube classics there as well. Tad Friend, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So if that little chunk of video in 2007 was the last time people checked in on YouTube, and of course, for most people, it's not. But if it were, what would they find is changing, taking over since then, Ted?
Well, in 2007, when you had Charlie biting his brother's finger and you had lots of cats disappearing down toilets and into swimming pools, cats getting wet was very popular. Mm-hmm. A lot of the video was sort of found video, either people going to the zoo or just shooting stuff in their backyard. And now it's become extremely professional. There are huge numbers of people with more than a million subscribers who vlog or video blog 3 or even 5 or even 7 times a week. And so people know that if I, look at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to see Shane Dawson and I can get my latest video from him. And it's sort of like more like regular programming, essentially from stars you come to know and trust rather than Charlie, who you see once and never hear from again.
You've got users watching more than 6 billion hours of video a month. That is kind of a mind-boggling number. What's the range of video people are watching, Ted?
It's everything. I mean, if you go to YouTube and search for any word you can think of, you can probably find a video that somehow connects to it, it's sort of this endless ocean. And when I went to the VidCon or video conference last summer in Anaheim, which is sort of the annual celebration of YouTube, there are now more than 1,000 people with a million subscribers on their channels. So that's an incredible number of people who are really famous to a lot of people but incredibly not famous to everyone else. And constantly there would be people being chased by 13-year-old girls down the sidewalk or through the corridors, everyone screaming, and everyone else would have no idea who they were. It was, Australian prank packs or singers or people who do spoken word recitals or lots of video bloggers who were 15-year-old kids who were very cute.
I mean, there's all the prank stuff and kind of general wonderful silliness. Then there are serious lectures. There's news out there. There's serious music out there. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Hollywood is looking at this as a venue for all kinds of creation and watching. And then all these individuals, as you say, nearly 1,000 who have more than a million visitors. One of the most popular, a Swedish guy PewDiePie. Real name is Felix Kjellberg from Sweden. He plays video games and sort of narrates and screams and makes jokes as he does. 32 million subscribers reportedly makes $4 million a year from his PewDiePie offer on YouTube. Here's a little bit of him playing Super Mario Brothers Supernatural 64.
We gotta sacrifice this penguin in the name of fashion. We gotta make some penguin skin boots.
It's a Prada penguin. We must make him into a pair of boots.
Oh, what are you
doing? Luigi, oh, I'm sorry.
Luigi,
don't leave me. Luigi.
That friend, who would have thunk it? He's sort of playing video games and kind of jabbering and making $4 million a year off advertising that flows through his YouTube offering.
I know. It is kind of extraordinary, and I think anyone who comes to it cold, as I did, and looks at it, you kind of stare in complete mystification about why he's so popular. But he's extremely popular with sort of 12 to 14-year-old boys who love video games and who love sort of being able to follow on to this kind of anarchic older brother figure who guides them through the new video games, who's very funny, who's very manic, who's very engaged. And, you know, when I wrote that piece, he had 32 million subscribers, and that was 2 months ago. Now he has 35 million subscribers. I mean, it's just growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, he is a huge, huge star, and almost anyone who's over 25 has never heard of him.
So when you're at this conference where all the YouTube acolytes and followers and producers and stars are gathering, in the middle of it, you've got Jeffrey Katzenberg sitting there, CEO of DreamWorks Animation. This is about as big as it gets in Hollywood territory. And he's calling YouTube the future of video entertainment. What does someone like Jeffrey Katzenberg see emerging here in cultural tastes and appetites, in the kinds of offerings that are going to dominate? What does he see when he looks at YouTube?
He told me that he thought within 5 years, YouTube would be the biggest media platform, bar none, in the entire planet. I think he sees the statistics you cited earlier, the 6 billion hours and so forth. And he also sees the fact that it's a great place if you have an animated movie. You can show little bits of it on YouTube. You can have the characters doing other things on YouTube. It's a way to drive lots of people back to your traditional media offerings. His company bought into an outfit called Awesomeness TV in 2013. They paid $33 million for it. And that's a kind of an aggregator of other channels. It kind of brings together YouTube stars and channels and makes it easier for advertisers to connect with them. He bought it for $33 million, and then he turned around at the end of last year and sold a quarter of it to Hearst for a valuation of 10 times that. I mean, I think every media property now sees that this is really something they want to be part of, and if they don't get in on it, they're going to be left behind.
And Awesomeness TV is sort of the equivalent of a television network or something? I mean, they're sort of organizing YouTube?
Yeah, it's organizing is a good way to put it. It's a little hard to make an exact analog. It's essentially like a kind of like a cable network sort of, but it basically aggregates stars and channels so that advertisers can, instead of just trying to find 5,000 people to advertise against, can advertise against Awesomeness TV and feel like they're getting, you know, great stars and some people will watch their ads.
Great stars, and of course big stars have been born there, Justin Bieber and a whole lot of others, and many more pouring in all the time. It remains a place where anyone can do it, and thousands of people are, some just for fun to share a family video, others looking to build a following and maybe a living off of it. Tad Friend with The New Yorker is with us. He's written wonderfully about this. Tad, we've got a lot of callers on this point. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Dustin, thank you for calling from Detroit. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay, what's your story?
Well, a year ago, instead of doing a regular theater show, I said, why don't we just start a TV show? And long story short, it based it off of my life. And so we do I Live My Life, and then we do a show about it, and we film it, and then we put it up on YouTube. This last show, we've even got sponsors for the first time. So I can see that it's like the wild, wild west right now, because I can do a show, I can put it up on YouTube, I can watch it on my phone, and then project it up on my big screen TV, just like you do with movies or any popular TV show on today.
How do we find it, Dustin? I see here it's sort of inspired by Colbert and Howard Stern. It's about your life. How do we find it on YouTube?
It's called Dustin's After Show, or the show starring Dustin Gardner. But that's the crazy thing, is I was looking for the name. There's already another TV show by some high schooler named Dustin Gardner, and it's mind-blowing that there's so many things already out there, let alone what I'm putting out there.
But you're doing it anyway. What's your hope? What's your dream, Dustin? Putting this up out of Detroit every day or however often you put it up, what's your vision?
Well, this last show we did in Halloween, which we're still editing and putting out, we gave away $3,000 worth of gifts and prizes. We had everyone dressed up and as a Halloween, you know, and as a Let's Make a Deal parody. And ultimately, there's 15 people in the show, and one day I could see us getting enough sponsors that we're able to make a living and actually do a TV show and have our own YouTube channel and you know, be out into the world. So I would love for me and my community of actors here in Detroit to be able to live off of it eventually.
There's the dream. Dustin's after show. Dustin Gardner, we wish you good luck out of Detroit. Tad Friend, it can sound far-fetched, but it has been done, and done a lot. It's being done every day right now.
Yeah, if you are one of the top stars on YouTube, you can definitely make a living at it. And to Dustin's point, increasingly there are scripted shows that are on the air, whether they're a talk show like it sounds like he's doing, or actually a sort of scripted drama or comedy. There's one called Video Game High School that's been very popular and is essentially like an MTV-style show that started off being sort of 10-minute episodes and has ended up being 30 or even 40-minute episodes. It's kind of grown, and the number of characters has grown, and the special effects budget, and it's become like an actual sort of TV show.
Jeffrey Katzenberg calls it snackable content. You write that the average length for YouTube offerings is 2 to 6 minutes. Of course, with Vine out there now, a competitor in a way, they're down to 6 seconds. Is this long form, short form YouTube? Will it be all of the above?
I think all of the above. The phrase that Hollywood likes to use, as you said, is snackable content. People also think of it as sort of interstitial content, in that if you're watching TV, you're often at least sort of mostly focused on that, although you may have a second screen up and be sort of chatting with your friends at the same time or tweeting about it. But if you're watching something, you know, in your pocket, as it were, or on the bus or on the subway or between classes or at lunch, the idea is you can just go watch a funny video that your friend sent you. It'll be, you know, 30 seconds or 2 minutes long, and then you can go back to whatever you're doing. And you can sort of do it as you're doing something else, and it's just accompaniment.
Tad Friend with The New Yorker. Please stand by there. It's great to have you. We're talking today about YouTube, now 10 years old, and its evolution. It still keeps right on rolling. Tad, stand by in New York. Listeners, you can join us. How do you use YouTube? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Oppa Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about YouTube at now 10 years old and its path from cute cat videos to changing the way we see and hear each other and the world. Behind us right there, the all-time most watched video on YouTube, Gangnam Style with South Korean pop singer Psy. It's been viewed more than 2 billion times. And many more have very big numbers as well. YouTube has just exploded. Tad Friend, staff writer for The New Yorker, joins us from New York this hour. His big article, The Stars of YouTube and Vine, published a couple months ago. You can link to it at our website. Really a good view of the video side of all this. How do you use YouTube these days? How much? How often? What do you see? Is it your go-to for humor, for sports clips, beauty tips, how-to videos, TV shows? Are you a YouTube celebrity yourself? What in your life is most important about YouTube? All kinds of material up there. Tons and tons of beauty tips. Here's another very popular YouTube contributor, Bethany Mota. She's 19 years old, has 8 million subscribers to her YouTube channel. She talks about doing things like decorating her room, putting on makeup, do-it-yourself projects aimed mainly at teenage girls. Here's a clip of her demonstrating her morning routine and how she styles her hair.
Whenever I want really quick waves, I'll just braid my hair into 4 braids or 2 braids if you want bigger waves, and I just tie that off, and then I go over it really quickly with a straightener. You don't even have to keep it on very long. Then you let it out, and you got perfect little waves, and then I'm just doing a French braid in my hair because I wanted to spice it up a little bit today.
Spice it up with a little French braid there, and you can see exactly how she does it, of course, because it's video. Is there news out there? Well, yes, there's news, and there's people pitching in their own version. Not too many days ago, where I'm sitting right now, hit by huge snowstorms, Boston in a couple of weeks. Here's a video posted by Mashable.com. A man standing outside his home in all that snow, videotaping the mountains of white stuff towering over his street.
Snow banks are as high as the house windows, taller than me, 7 feet. This snow bank is absurd.
Almost anything you want to see is there, and stars are and have been made there. Justin Bieber was discovered on YouTube when he started posting videos of himself singing when he was just 12 years old. Those videos got him attention and a record deal. Here he is, Justin Bieber, playing guitar and singing Cry Me a River by Justin Timberlake in 2008, 12 years old. The music side of YouTube has just exploded. Tad Friend standby in New York. Angela Watercutter joins us right now from San Francisco, editor and writer, covers pop culture and the media at Wired magazine. Angela Watercutter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to us about how music is listened to or music videos are watched on YouTube, the volume of it, the significance of it today.
I mean, I think music is such a great sort of wide spectrum already, and on YouTube it kind of has the opportunity for everybody from Justin Bieber many years ago until now, he's very much more famous, to kind of have a space to play. And I feel like over time, eventually people who couldn't find some sort of obscure song or something like that would found a way to just go on YouTube and probably find it. It was like, you know, finding an old Grateful Dead bootleg or something. Like, everything ended up being on YouTube. And so it became sort of a de facto backup music player. You could DJ through YouTube just by finding, you know, almost anything you could look for. Plus, you know, even though music videos kind of have kind of come and gone, artists still make them and they still make great music videos, and they now live more on YouTube, I think, even than they do on traditional cable networks. So people are able to, you know, jump from, you know, Taylor Swift to a bootleg to a DJ's remix of some song, you know, from the other side of the world. So it's this great place where people can sort of get a mix of all different kinds of music that's just been uploaded to the service.
And why would somebody go to YouTube to listen to music as opposed to all the other possibilities out there, Spotify and Beats and Pandora and all the rest, Angela?
Like I said, I think it just has a lot to do with, because the nature of YouTube is that anybody can upload, you know, a DJ who, you know, just made a mix that morning can put it on YouTube very quickly versus, you know, it's harder to get on iTunes or Spotify or something like that. So if you're that Justin Bieber character who is just playing guitar in your bedroom or what, something like that, you are able to reach a much wider audience. And I think a lot of people, you know, discovering music is such a, you know, there's just so much to get through now. Going through YouTube, you know, you can kind of find related artists, things that sound like this, things that don't. And it's just a great way to discover new music that you maybe hadn't before and that you couldn't through a slightly more traditional service.
YouTube started beta testing a for-pay music video service last fall called Music Key. How's that going?
I think it's going well. I think it sort of tapped into, like, YouTube kind of just saw what was happening and tapped into that and realized that people were using YouTube as a music player. And so they kind of developed something that let them do that. And I think it kind of cracked this great code in that it allowed people to play their music through YouTube on mobile. So you were able to use it in your pocket like you were using iTunes. It used to be you could watch YouTube on your phone all the time, but as soon as you locked it, the music would stop or the video would stop, so you couldn't just, you know, sort of put it in your pocket and forget about it. And now it kind of allows that to happen. And I think it's just kind of, again, it's sort of created a great ecosystem where I can, you know, take a Taylor Swift song and mix it with, you know, somebody more obscure from Sweden or something like that, and kind of make a playlist out of all of the different things that are available in the service.
You've got all kinds of pranks and comedy and music and home video and news and rants and raves on YouTube. Just in the last few weeks, we had the trio of YouTube personalities interviewing the President of the United States in the White House. We'll hear from one of them in a moment. Of course, Google bought it in 2006, just a couple of years, a year or so into its life, for $1.65 billion. I don't know what valuation is put on it today. It's just embedded in Google. But Tad Friend, I'm struck here with all of the scale of this and the volume of users, billions of users. In 2014, YouTube will log $1.13 billion in ad revenue. That's a big number, but it's small compared to other media players. I mean, just take CBS, for example, brought in almost $9 billion last year with, I would think, smaller audience than YouTube by a long shot. $200 billion spent globally on TV advertising. What's with the revenue piece of this for YouTube? $1.13 billion in the Google universe doesn't sound too big, Ted.
It doesn't, and I'm not sure where you got that number. YouTube doesn't release its number, and there are a bunch of different estimates. I've heard numbers as high as $5 billion. I've heard $3.4 billion.
This is an estimate from the New York Times publishing an estimate from eMarketer. It's a marketing research company.
Yeah. Well, eMarketer has also changed its estimates a few times. So there are different estimates. The general agreement is that it is way less than something like a CBS, and you would think, to your point, that with that many videos out there, that big an audience, that they should be able to make more money off of it. I guess the problem they've had from the advertisers, think of it as sort of this teeming ocean that's endless. And where do you find somebody if you, you know, which ads are you putting up against? You sort of worry that it disappears, whereas you know if you're advertising on Two and a Half Men, you know, a certain audience is going to be watching it somewhat reluctantly every week. So Google, they have a service called Google Preferred that YouTube has put up so that you can advertise against people you know are having have lots of subscribers. The top 1% or the top 5% of the channels in the YouTube universe, so that you can feel like people are actually coming and watching it instead of just, you know, some guy in Anaheim, you know, shooting out his backyard. That's what they're trying to do. They still have had problems sort of generating significant revenue. And as a result, a lot of the worry at YouTube is that a lot of their biggest creators are going to leave YouTube or using it sort of as a trampoline or a springboard to traditional media, and that they will leave taking their audiences with them. So they're trying to develop shows now with those stars to convince them to stay at YouTube so that they can keep them there for the ad revenues.
Tad Friend, Angela Watercutter, stand by. Henry's calling from Miami Beach, Florida. Hi, Henry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was very surprised when my son, who had recently moved out to L.A., told me that he was producing and directing and writing YouTube stuff, because I thought, well, you just graduated from Yale. Isn't this what stuff kids that, you know, are in high school do?
Yeah, get a real job, son.
What? You get a well, he has a real job at a real production company, and he was doing this, and it was, I just didn't get it. And they did a six-episode series, and the second episode got 4 million hits, and I was stunned. And that's when I started to understand what YouTube is doing and how amazing it is. And now, you know, now he from this series called Girls Are, I can't even say the last word, but it starts with an A and ends with a hole. That's the name of the series, also very saddening to a mother to hear.
Yes.
He has an agent, and they are pitching him to amazing people. And this is all from, I mean, they did it in a very professional way. They hired, you know, they hired actresses, and they had a real script. But each episode was a minute and a half, 2 minutes. One episode was 17 seconds.
So how is your son defining success at this point, Henry? Does he feel like he's there, or does he want to ride this to some, you know, big feature film at Paramount, and then he will have made it, or what?
Well, yes, he doesn't necessarily. This is not his goal, just to be making YouTube videos, although he knows that, I mean, he has sponsors for his videos, but he is being pitched to television shows now, and he understands that this is just one of the steps that you can take in order to get to television series and feature films and independent films and shorts and all of, you know, maybe
sure.
I did that in the wrong...
The wrong order? Doesn't matter. The whole thing, we get it. Here's the way in, and it's not just fooling around. It sounds like it's actually working. I appreciate your call from Miami Beach. Tad Friend, what about the pipeline now? What's the new sort of path of ascent for people, or are there many?
Well, I talked to a woman named Brittany Furlan, who is a Vine star. You were talking about Vine earlier, the six-second video service. She has 10 million followers on Vine, and her agents said to her, our goal is to transform you from Vine to YouTube and then from YouTube to television. So I think a lot of people see sort of Vine as the way to start. Then you maybe make it over to YouTube. That's sort of the AAA ball, and then they still think of the majors as TV or film. That said, there are plenty of people who are big on YouTube who are perfectly happy just being on YouTube. There's Hannah Hart has a show called My Drunk Kitchen, and she has made some on-demand movies with her friends, Grace Helbig, among them. And she feels like having video online, even if I'm doing a movie or if I'm doing vlogging to my fans, that's fine. I don't need to necessarily be all over America. I don't need to be in every movie theater. I'm very happy with my large but contained audience.
And you never know where it's going to go. In just a second, we're going to talk with Glozell Green. She made a name with comedy on YouTube, doing some kind of stunts. Here's a little video where it's been watched more than 42 million times, where she's challenged to gobble down some cinnamon. That's not easy to do. She ended up last month interviewing the President of the United States. Here she was.
So 150 kabillion people have been asking me to do the cinnamon challenge. If you go to my fan page on Facebook or any comments from the last couple of videos I put up, I did a cinnamon challenge. And I usually don't give in to peer pressure because what's so challenging about cinnamon? Really?
Lozelle Green in 2012 trying to choke down a spoonful of cinnamon. Here she was last month, one of three YouTube representatives interviewing the President of the United States.
How can we bridge the gap between black African-American males and white cops?
Well, first of all, you know, we always have to just remind ourselves that the overwhelming majority of police officers, they are doing a really tough job and they're doing it well and they're doing it professionally.
Lozelle Green joins us now from Los Angeles, comedian, vlogger, known as Queen of YouTube, over 3 million subscribers to her channel, one of those three, interviewing President Obama last month. Lozelle Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Were you pinching yourself if one day you're choking down cinnamon, the next day you're interviewing the president?
I am still in shock. It is amazing what YouTube can do for a person.
Why do you think President Obama was prepared to sit down with three YouTube reps to talk about his policy before State of the Union around it?
Well, the internet has been a great vehicle for him to even get into office. So I think it's great that he is continuing to still remember, hey, there's a lot of people and there's a lot of young people that need to know more about politics that are listening to YouTubers. So that was an excellent route. And I think you'll see more politicians using us YouTubers in the future.
Lozelle, what's your vision of a career based in YouTube? Will, do you expect to stay there in your dreams? Do you become, you know, something else like a TV star or a movie star? Or is YouTube your natural home? How do you think about it?
Well, in the beginning, it was always television and film. I have a BFA in musical theater, so I thought that was the logical route. I did stand up. But then I did a blog and I uploaded something on YouTube. And that was when my first viral hit happened, over 10 million and then 20 million. I was like, what? That was called my push-up bra. And I was like, well, this is the audience. This is going to help me get on television and film. Then I realized, and it was just recently, I'm going, what am I going to television and film for when I can wake up when I want to, do whatever videos I want to? I'm making a living like this between the revenue, the ads, and T-shirt sales, and meet and greets. What? I don't even know what more you could ask for. Everybody knows who I am. I cannot walk outside at any time of the day, grocery store, anything. So I'm really happy where I am.
And what does YouTube push you toward in terms of what you do? 2 years ago, it was, you know, choking down cinnamon. Mm-hmm. Do you have a, like, can you bring your whole self to this project, or does YouTube just want, like, cheap stunts?
Well, obviously, it's not just cheap stunts because YouTube and Google and the White House brought a few of us to interview the president.
Fair enough.
So they honestly thought if I'm just going to be a complete idiot, you know, you had to get approved by not just, you know, from YouTube, Google, and the White House.
Oh, yeah. But as a comedian, I mean, there you were mm-hmm. doing something very special, and
right.
good on you for doing it. But as a comedian,
right.
do you feel like YouTube allows you to go where you want to go, or is there a culture that keeps turning you back toward, I don't know what, you know, next you eat something weird?
Well, that happens to be pretty popular. I have, yeah. I don't even know what else I could possibly eat, but I had over 2,000 videos and was making a living before the cinnamon challenge, over 2,000 videos.
Yeah.
So, and I would talk about music because that was my background, play the piano, sing.
Yep.
So that is what has become popular to people who don't overly look at YouTube because those videos will share it to parents, grandparents. Like, look at this fool. This is crazy. But my fans, they've seen way more than that, from serious subjects, answering questions, to the silly.
Lozelle Green is big on YouTube. She's with us from Los Angeles. Lozelle, please stand by right there. Queen of YouTube. Angela Watercutter is with us from Wired. She covers pop culture and media all over music and YouTube. Tad Friend is staff writer for The New Yorker. He wrote the article, The Stars of YouTube and Vine, in the mid-December issue of The New Yorker. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Imagine having a personal library with over 150,000 book titles, plus magazine and newspapers like The New York Times and Wall Street Journal. Now imagine having a personal assistant read them to you in the car, on the train, wherever you want. That's what it's like to have Audible.com. On Point listeners get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Go to audible.com/onpoint. Choose a free title and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about YouTube at now 10 years old and its path from cute cat videos to changing the way we see each other and maybe the world. You can find, learn, see just about anything on YouTube. How-to videos are huge. Need to change a belt in your dryer? Go to YouTube.
Next, we need to release the belt from the idler. So we're reaching over on top of the exhaust. Find the idler pulley. Pull it towards the left. And with our right hand, we'll roll the belt off the motor pulley.
How to, and I mean how to anything on YouTube. Those are very popular, but news as well, music, entertainment, all kinds of things. Right into politics. Back in 2006, Republican Senator George Allen of Virginia called out a dark-complexioned Indian American at a campaign rally with a racial slur that was caught on video posted to YouTube. His campaign had a lot of damage control to do. He lost the election.
My friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas. And it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere.
Boom, and the hammer came down, and his political life got very tough in a hurry. Ted, friend, I mean, one of the things going on here is the things that would not have made the evening news 20 years ago or maybe found any real outlet. They're there. You can find anything and everything. Nothing's buried anymore.
Yeah, everything, it's probably politicians' version of hell because everything is there. Nothing ever goes away. Everything is instantly searchable. In the old days, you know, newspapers would wrap fish the next day and then go into the files and that was it. And now sort of everything is at your fingertips all the time.
Soso's calling from Clinton Township, Michigan. Soso, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point about the news. And I'm 18, and I'm about to go to college. And for me, I think overall, the news, I go to YouTube first, then I do traditional news outlet media. So I don't go to CNN. I do not go to the BBC. I don't go to Al Jazeera. I go to YouTube first.
And what kind of news are you looking for, so political or geopolitical or entertainment, what?
Not entertainment, more political and geopolitical. If anything comes to, for example, with Arab Springs about a few years ago,
yeah.
I went to the Philip DeFranco show, which is a channel on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that's where I went for my news first, because I find that traditional media has become more and more biased, and it's no longer presenting you the facts as they did maybe 20, 30 years ago. Instead, it's pushing an agenda, as you see with, you know, radical stations such as Fox and MSNBC on both sides of the spectrum. But I find that the political, or the Philip DeFranco show, is a very facts-based show in which the creator, Philip DeFranco, he even repeats multiple times throughout his videos that he does not like stating his own opinion. He wants the viewers and his audience to find their opinions and start a discussion on both YouTube, on Google, on his website. And that's what I find really impressive about his channel and what I look for from my news media that I don't get through traditional outlets anymore.
So I really appreciate your call and thank you for it. Glozell Green, there's an 18-year-old listener who goes to YouTube first for her news. You were there with news right out of the White House. Where do you get your news? Is it YouTube, Glozell, or somewhere else?
Of course it's YouTube, because you know that it's fresh, it's new, it's right there, and you're getting opinions that is not biased through payment or advertisers or anything. So that is the number one place to go, especially as a YouTuber.
But I mean,
what are my fans talking about?
It could be biased. Why not? I mean, somebody with a biased view of news could give news there too, right? I mean, presumably.
That is definitely true, but you have several sources, and then you can come up with your own conclusion. You know, say I don't always just go to NBC, ABC, Fox. I go to my YouTube, and what are my fans talking about? And my fans are from all across the world. So if something's going on in Pakistan, my Pakistan fans are like, this is right. This is true. This is what's going on, Glozell. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this? Look at this. This is what's going on. I have friends that call. I went to that have friends that, from Israel, and they're like, oh, my, I have other fans like, this is not called Israel. And that's where I learned how these issues come up, and religion, everything is right there on YouTube from the people, you know, that are going through whatever that's in the news.
Angela, what?
Directly.
Yep. Angela, how do you see this strand of YouTube offering the news and how people decide where they're going to place their trust in that great welter of offerings on YouTube?
Well, I think to Glazell's point, it's, you know, it's interesting because on YouTube there's sort of no plausible deniability. You know, if there's something that happens like, you know, the Arab Spring or something like that, I mean, if you can see it, you know, mm-hmm. I guess you could theoretically alter a video or something like that. But if you can see something happening, then you know it's true. If a politician says something that they didn't mean to say or did mean to right. say but didn't mean to have recorded, you know, they will see. You can go on YouTube and you can kind of judge for yourself. So there is that element of it going straight from, you know, literally somebody's camera phone to online to as many people as possible who can watch it. So there's less, you know, filtering that happens that way, which, you know, has good or bad outcomes, but I think it does allow a lot more people. You can kind of go down that rabbit hole and be like, I saw this on the news, now I'm going to watch that full clip, now I'm going to see mm-hmm. what exactly came out of, you know, this particular news bit. So yeah, I think that's really valuable.
Exhibit A, maybe in that category, Mitt Romney, when he made those comments about the 47%, the film yeah. was leaked to Mother Jones, but did they have an outlet for it? You bet they did. YouTube.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
And there's no chokehold on that. It went through Mother Jones, but it went right to YouTube. And on it goes. Tad Friend, what's your sense of how this ultimately changes our sense of ourselves and the world when there is no there's no filter or conductor here? YouTube can basically and does take almost anything coming up, Tad.
It does. And the dark side of it, of course, is something like ISIS or ISIL can use YouTube and Twitter and often does to try to get out their message and their execution videos and so forth because they think there won't be a filter there. And obviously YouTube and Twitter try to keep those out. But there is no filter. I think the optimistic great thing about it is you can hear listening to Glazell why she has 3 million subscribers. If I were on YouTube, I'd have about 8 subscribers. Glazell is optimistic. She is energetic, and yeah. And you can sort of tell, like, you're gonna what you see and what you hear is what you're gonna get. And I think the people who connect on YouTube, again to Glazell's point about having 2,000 videos before the Cinnamon one, you're seeing like all of someone's life, you know, every mm-hmm. bit of it that they care to show you. But often it's hard to, even for something like 3 or 4 minutes, if you're just staring at the camera, it's hard to kind of deny who you are. You have to you're showing. You know, every little bit of it, you're seeing someone's house. You know, the little brother walks through, the cat comes in, and you're kind of, even when someone's sad, they're vlogging and they're talking about, you know, breaking up with someone or someone who died, mm-hmm. and you're getting a sense of really who they are, where you never really had a sense necessarily of who Brian Williams was on NBC. You got a sense of who he wanted to be, but you didn't know who he really was.
Glazell, do you think we get closer to truth with this deluge of videos on YouTube, or does it turn us into a nation, a world of performers all the time?
Well, I think when you start, you're definitely just, because you don't know that you're going to be famous or this or what's going to mm-hmm. trigger something. Like I didn't, and YouTube wasn't what it was now. I was just putting up videos, putting up my ideas in hopes of, well, maybe somebody will pick it up and I'll have a studio and I can really do things. But that's not what happened. I think that people really feel that they know you because they do see you in all types of walk of life, and whenever you're performing, they could tell that it's fake. And usually a lot of videos that have a lot of editing and this and that, they don't do as well as something like Charlie Bit My Finger
yeah.
or some of me just taking cinnamon. That was it was just me and a camera.
Right.
That was, and not even a special camera. I got it from like Target.
Yeah.
You know, like I use my phone, you know, so you can spend a lot of money, but people know when things are not real, whether you use a lot of money to make your videos or not.
Yep.
And that's where people connect. If not, they can just watch television and watch actors.
Yeah.
And that's fine, too.
Real in the moment, and people like it. And, of course, real across all kinds of time here as more and more from the past
yes.
gets brought onto YouTube.
Exactly right.
Tom in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a
I have a 96-year-old mother in a nursing home, and I'm 67.
Okay.
And one of the things we do when I visit her a couple of times a week is we play a little game with my cell phone. And I bring up a browser, and I can tell her to think of the name of any song or any artist or any group back from the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. And I'll type it into the browser and add the word YouTube to it,
yeah.
Punch the send or the enter button, and yeah. It comes up. And I can point to the little speaker at the end of the phone towards her ear, and she can listen to it and sing along with it. And it's one of the greatest things of her life. You know, when you're that old, you have very few pleasures left in life, but she really gets off on it.
So if you want Bing Crosby and Bob Hope on the road, boom, bingo, it's there. Or you name it, Buster Keaton, go all the way back, it's
Patty
there.
Patty Page, Barry Como, Guy Lombardo, greatest hits of the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
To me, it's kind of a cultural and technological shock. I was a high-speed Morse code operator in 1969 in the Navy in Vietnam, and now I've got this little thing in my hand that does much more than a transmitter the size of a refrigerator used to do.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, what a great game to play with your mom at 96. That really makes it vivid to us. I appreciate your call from Dodgeville. Ted Friend, I mean, talk about a magical medium. His mother can look back over more or less a century, and anything that crosses her mind, it's going to be there on YouTube.
I know it is. We kind of take it for granted now, but it is amazing, you know, 10 years... On the one hand, it seems like a long stretch of time, but it actually wasn't that long ago that, you know, Chad was celebrating the fact that, you know, Google had bought them in that famous video where he was sort of dancing around saying, you know, basically there was a little air of like, I can't believe this company actually took us seriously and bought us for this much money.
Yeah.
But now you look around and you think, you know, yeah, they it's a repository of the high points of human civilization, at least for the last, you know, 70 or 80 years, and it's like that should be celebrated, and that is worth at least $1.65 billion.
High points of civilization and Charlie bit my finger. Shaheen.
That is one of the high points
yeah,
of civilization.
Okay. Oh, pardon me. Shaheen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shaheen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if your guest can comment on YouTube Space. I think it's a fantastic area they're getting into and supporting artists, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Shaheen. Tad, I'll come first to you on that. I mean, YouTube Space, the YouTube is now building something like studios, right? Where people
yeah.
can come in and have a higher quality cameras and studio space to make. What's the point here?
I think the point is to celebrate and sustain their artists and creators. They built one in Tokyo, one in New York, and a big one, 41,000 square feet in Los Angeles that I went and visited. And it really is impressive. It's where Howard Hughes used to have his airplane hangar.
Wow.
And it's a gigantic thing. And it has huge sound stages and recording stages. And it's you really feel like you could be at Paramount or Universal or Sony in its scope and its professionalism and it has prop departments. It has Google Glass when there was a Google Glass you could wear on a show. And the idea is to sort of up everyone's game. You can come in. You can learn how to use a Red Epic camera and learn how to use three-point lighting. If you're already on Oprah's show, came and kind of embedded there for a while and her network, and you can use it to sort of connect with younger audiences. And I think the idea is just like it's a way of spending a lot of money, but the idea is that it'll ultimately come back and make everyone's videos better, make more money from advertising, kind of raise the bar for expectations for how well you have to shoot a video.
Glozell Green, as a YouTube star already yourself who didn't need a soundstage to get there, how do you look at this YouTube Space and this kind of professionalizing angle, sound stages and recording stages and all the rest? Do you feel like, you know, chopped liver if you're not in there now, or is that just one stream?
I love the YouTube Space. I'm there all the time. What works for me there is a lot of collabs, because a lot of us are working in our house or things like that. And some of us are not all in LA, so we can meet in a safe place and do your collabs and have other people film, because we're filming ourselves and we're editing ourselves. But there you have that opportunity. And if I was going to interview, let's say, someone like Lady Gaga, she might not want to come to my living room or my bedroom.
Yes.
You know, So I see a lot of those kind of things happen on top of shows that are made for YouTube and anybody else that want to use it. I love it. It's a family. You get to know everybody, and you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, and we meet up there.
What's your dream? What's your dream now, Glozelle? You've gone from cinnamon, choking to interviewing the president of the United States at the White House. What's your dream vision for a life in YouTube, if that's what it is?
Well, I forever will have a life in YouTube because every time there's a new phone that comes out, a new .com that comes out, people use videos, and they use videos that people already laughed at. So the audience is there, the residuals from some of the stuff I've already done. But to just keep going on, I've been sustaining. A lot of people come and go or have that hit and go. And fortunately, I've had sustainability. So I like to keep going with that. I also just did a movie, The Wedding Ringer. So because they're like, bring your YouTube video audience to the main screen because they know that I come with an audience. So they're using YouTubers in all different kinds of ways. So it's all good, me.
Glozelle, we see what made you popular on YouTube loud and clear.
Thank
it
you.
Comes across with no visuals included. It comes straight across. We wish you really good luck. Glozelle Green, the queen of YouTube, thank you very much. Thank you for being with us today from L.A.
Bye.
Angela Watercutter, our time is wrapping up here. It's been wonderful talking with you today. Thanks for bringing us some insight into the music side of all this. Great to have you along.
Thank you so much for having me.
Angela Watercutter, editor and writer at Wired, joining us from San Francisco. And Tad Friend, you really dug in deep and put a rudder under the whole thing for us. We're grateful to you. Staff writer at The New Yorker. This piece was The Stars of YouTube and Vine. Tad, thanks for joining us from New York.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross. With help from Julia Corcoran, Araz Havan, and Caitlin O'Keefe, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.